And lots of more texts about Simon Harris. There's one here. Simon Harris is a good guy. Watching him on TV, he's hounded and he looks a bit tired. He needs to be left alone. Joanna, well, we'll leave him alone for now. My next guest has, I think, kind of quietly established herself as probably one of the most successful Irish writers of recent years. Tana French's Dublin Murder Squad books have been huge, not just in Ireland, but in the UK and in the States as well. Her new book is a bit different. Probably you describe it as a dysfunctional Irish family saga and kind of nod to the Me Too era as well. Tana French, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me on. Lovely to be here.
Now, Tana, your previous books has been a lot of police procedural aspect to them, and I know you have a detective friend who helps you out with that. I thought the portrayal of Toby, the main character in your new book, The Witch Elm, he has a brain injury, and we see the whole story, mainly 500 pages of it, through his lens. So you're seeing it through the lens of somebody with a brain injury, which must have been a very difficult thing to do, was it?
Oh, that involved a lot of research, because if you're dealing with something so huge, not only brain injury but post-traumatic stress, these are life-transforming things, and you don't want to take that lightly. Like, if you're going to write about something like that, you have to do it justice. So I did a lot of research on the effects of it and on support forums for brain injury sufferers. And because it's not just the brain injury itself, which can lead to physical changes and psychological ones. It's also the sense of loss of self that can be huge. Just the sense that if you're no longer the person you were, maybe you have mood swings you didn't expect, maybe you can't do some things you used to, you can't concentrate. It's the sense that you're no longer who you were. And that loss of self is terrifying and traumatic in itself.
And as well as playing around with that kind of identity and who we are and everything, it's also about how there's a lot in the book about how our memories, which are also our sense of self, the stories we tell ourselves, how they play tricks on us.
Oh yeah, we're unreliable narrators in our own lives. Like, if you look at, you ask three siblings about an argument they had when they were little, you're going to get three entirely different stories, because we construct our own memories, sometimes almost deliberately to show ourselves in the best light, but sometimes because we remember what's top priority to us. And that's what happens with Toby and his cousins. He thinks they've had basically an idyllic, charmed life, bopping around the old ancestral family home, kids' picnics and teenage parties, and it's all been lovely. But when he's drawn back after this brain injury to stay in the old family home, and his cousins are in and out a lot, I'm not giving anything away here, but a skeleton is discovered down a hole in a tree in the family garden. And from that, things start to unravel, and he starts to realize that his cousins' memories of their childhood, and especially teenage years together, are not the same as his, and that what they were living was very different from what he was living. And that means, can he really have any faith in what he considered to be his own past, or is that under siege as well?
Because in a sense Toby had a different life, and this is one of the kind of zeitgeisty things you tick here, which is probably white male privilege, that he's the first line in the book is I've always considered myself a lucky kind of guy, and Toby is an example of how a person with privilege lives a very different life to other people, isn't he? Even if he's going through the same events as such.
Oh yeah, I mean, he's living life on the easiest difficulty setting. But that's what I was thinking about with this book, was kind of the connection between luck and empathy. And if you're too lucky in one area, it can stop you realizing that other people are probably having a very different experience of life on a day-to-day basis. And I mean, Toby's rolled sixes in every way. Like, he is affluent, which is probably the biggest factor in making his experience easier. He's white, he's male, he's straight, he's good looking, loving, supportive family. Everything's kind of gone his way. But I mean, all of us, I think, or almost all of us, have areas in which we're playing on the easy difficulty setting and areas in which we're playing on the most difficult one. And the challenge is to be aware of it and to go, hang on, people are having very different experiences. And I think Toby, because he's never had the high difficulty setting, is completely unaware that other people are living in a different world, and that others' experience of just having a day-to-day life in this society is not the same as his. And when his luck gets ripped away from him, because he's no longer physically and mentally healthy, he suddenly realizes that the world is not what he always thought. And it's quite intimidating, yeah.
So in that sense, that we all need to fall off the horse at some stage in our lives to realise, actually, you know, I've been very lucky up to now.
Oh, yeah.
and to feel for other people and their stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the example I've been using is I was lucky in that I had a happy, loving, loved childhood. I mean, not perfect or anything, but there was nothing horrific in there. I was basically loved and supported all the way. And when I was a teenager and somebody would be saying that, you know, their childhood wasn't that way or their parents were not loving and supportive and talking about something awful that had happened, there would be a part of my mind going, I can't have been that bad. They've got to be exaggerating a bit. And it wasn't that I didn't believe them. It was just that this was so far outside my frame of reference that I just couldn't take in that it was real. Now I grew up and realized that my experience isn't the definer for everyone else's. But we all need to have that moment where we go, oh, hang on, just because this hasn't been my reality, that doesn't mean it's not someone else's.
So check your privilege, as they say.
I wasn't thinking of it in that way, but yeah, probably.
Your background is very interesting. So I suppose the best writers are kind of tend to be outsiders and observers and everything. And you moved around a lot growing up, but your actual background is Italian, Russian, Irish, American, correct?
Yeah, give or take. Yeah, with a little bit of having travelled around all over the place. But I think you're right. We get everywhere international brats. I think it's a good background for like a writer or an actor or anyone, because you get very aware of little cultural nuances. You have to be. If you're moving into a place, you have to be very observant about things like, okay, what's the conversational distance? How far do I stand from somebody? How much do I gesture within a conversation? Because otherwise you're going to come across as a weirdo. So you have to be very on top of the little cultural signals. I think that's an advantage for a writer because you don't take things for granted. You're noticing what things signal what, and you can use that in writing.
So you almost learn to kind of start mimicking the people around you in a sense.
Well, you're speaking it's learning a new language in
all the time.
Yeah, in nonverbal ways.
Yeah. So you started out in Africa, am I right?
I was born in the US, moved to Florence, moved back to the US, moved to Africa, moved to Rome, moved back here, and I am staying put.
Okay, so the bulk of your growing up, your younger childhood was spent in Africa.
Yeah,
is that
Malawi.
Right, in Malawi?
Yeah.
Yeah. And people who grow... Now, I'll tell you what, we'll talk about this more in a minute. I actually need to take a break now, and we're going to take Angelus and news then. So Tana French, you'll stay with us, will you?
I'll be here.
Okay, we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Thanks, Ciara. And Tana French, the writer, is still with us. Her new book is called The Witch Elm. And we were just talking about the fact that Tana had quite a peripatetic childhood. So Tana, you spent a lot of your childhood in Malawi. People who kind of spent some childhood or grew up in Africa who are expats, they tend to talk about it, I find, in a very romantic way. They have very happy memories of there and feel a kind of a connection back to the place. It's almost a magical place for them. Is that the case for you?
Definitely. I mean, when you're a child, when you're, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, you don't see anything as odd or strange. You just take for granted whatever's around you. And if there are problems, you're much less likely to notice them if they're not right up in your face. I mean, Malawi had multiple social, political, all kinds of problems when I was a kid, when I was living there. But I didn't know that. All I knew is there's this huge amount of space and you and your friends can run wild and climb trees. And, you know, you have to watch out for snakes and you shouldn't go outside the fence because there could be hyenas there. And, you know, mind out when you're swimming in the lake because there's hippos and they're really, really dangerous. But you just take that for granted, the way, you know, you would take for granted that you have to mind out for the traffic if you were living here. It was a wonderful place to be a child.
And I guess you had quite a different experience to your average person living in Malawi, didn't
she?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. To your average Malawian child, I was having an entirely different, hugely privileged, and I'm not sure luxurious is the word, because certain things affect everybody. If there's a shortage of, you know, petrol or various foodstuffs, that affects everybody across the board, or did in those days. But no, we had protection from weather events and famine and all these things that your average Malawian child living a few hundred yards away would absolutely not have had. We very, very privileged and very almost illusorily idyllic, if that's even a word, or if I didn't come up with it. But that's what you remember.
And then you arrive in Rome at 11 or 12. So you must have been this kind of hick from Africa who'd been running wild around the fields, and you arrive into Rome. A huge culture shock, I imagine.
All over the place. I couldn't believe just the amount of crowds there were. The fact that you couldn't walk down a street without dodging people. There was nowhere to just run around. And I also couldn't believe there was a high degree of conformism. Like in Malawi, the cool thing was something that nobody else had, because the amount of stuff for sale was really small and really limited. So the cool school bag was one that, you know, maybe your uncle in America had sent you, and it had more pockets and it had more colours and it was different. Mm. And you get to Rome, and what was cool was what was exactly like everybody else had. You know, there were certain haircuts you had to have. There were certain jeans you had to have, a certain brand of school bag that you had to have. And this was a huge switch for my mind, the idea that it was better to be exactly like everybody else, when I was used to, it was better to have the thing that was that bit different. That was what was valued. So the entire system of priorities and values is very different. And I had a really hard time getting my head around it.
And were you a bookish kind of a child?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Malawi, 80s, there wasn't any TV. That didn't exist. So unless you had your mates, and we for a while lived quite far out in the bush, so I didn't have mates nearby, books were your main source of entertainment. Books and like playing with your little brother, which can run out after a while. So I was one of those kids who do total immersion reading. You give me a book and I'm gone until the last page. And I miss that. And I think there are ways in which I still long for that and look for books that are like that and try to write books that will tempt people, even though they shouldn't be, you know, when you should be doing other stuff. I love when people say, oh, I stayed up reading it way past my bedtime, because I'd love to give people that total immersion reading that I had.
And I will say to you, that's exactly what happened to me with the second half of The Witch Elm the other night. I got going, couldn't stop. So the thing is, you do write a lot about friendship and everything, and the importance of friendship. And I guess, is it odd for a kid moving around like that? You say there weren't other kids really to be friends with in Malawi. Then you land in Rome at what is it? Tricky enough age for people and everything. And is it hard uprooting then and moving and, you know, losing friends, trying to make new friends, all that?
I think that's probably why I value it so much in my books, because I did have, you know, amazing school friends in Malawi, some of whom I'm still friends with now, and in Rome as well. But it was international school, so everybody was always moving. It wasn't just me. There's this sense that friendship is something that could be whipped away from you at any moment. And so I think that's probably one reason why I value it so much, because you had to fight for it. You had to write letters. There's no email, there's no WhatsApp. You have to write letters that take 6 weeks to get either way. Friendship is something worth fighting for. And I also think it's undervalued in literature a lot of the time. You'll get books that explore the value of romantic love, of family love, but you don't get that many that explore how huge and powerful and valuable friendship can be within someone's life. I don't think that's had the space within literature that it really deserves. And I come back to it again and again, because these friendships, they're what define you to a large extent. As a child, and in particular as a teenager, they can shape you for life. And I love coming back to that.
And Ireland is very much home now.
Yeah.
And it again, you've kind of taken that slightly gimlet outsider's eye to Ireland at times. So your book Broken Harbour was set in a ghost estate. And you described in talking about it how you wrote a piece for the New York Times about this kind of thing and the economic crash and everything. It was very interesting. So you say that, like, Irish people are naturally cynical, but that it all got washed away by the Celtic Tiger. Our natural cynicism that would have protected us there was gone.
Yeah, in some way or other, I think what did it was the Irish emphasis on home, which of course has, you know, roots, historical roots going back centuries with a lack of ability to own property. We're so passionate about having a home, Irish people, that it's as if owning your own home is the only safety. And when this was held up in the Celtic Tiger, in the terms that it was presented, you have to get onto that property letter, you have to, or you never will have that home. Must get onto it by buying a house in some non-existent estate out in a floodplain somewhere in North County Dublin or so. People fell for it because this is so huge culturally in our minds, the concept of home and of owning your own home. So that idea of going, hang on, that is a field on a floodplain. I don't want to pay 400 grand for it. That got washed away because it's so precious to us, the idea of home. And I'm saying us as if I'm I belong, which I, of course, don't completely, but I understand this. I understand the value of home. And I think people did. And that was what was quite heartbreaking about the boom and the crash, is that it was my generation, to a large extent, who got slammed and devastated by the boom. We were lucky we didn't have enough money to buy a shed in Offaly during the boom, so we escaped. But so many people, the ones who didn't escape, were the ones who were trying so hard to do the right thing, who really wanted to have a good job and a good home for their family, and who, when they were told, this is how you have to do it, if you do these things, then you will inevitably have a safe home for life, they did it. They did what they were told by banks and developers and the government. They did what they were told was the right thing. And then all of that turned around and kicked them in the teeth. And it must have been psychologically as well as financially devastating. I think Broken Harbour came out of that, out of seeing my generation be devastated by this thing that should never have happened.
And in terms of your own life and your own luck, you've obviously had, I'm sure you could afford a shed in Offaly now, you've had enormous success. Was it a surprise to you?
It's still a surprise to me. This wasn't the plan, you know. I was acting, I wasn't planning on writing, I had this idea, and I was so far behind through the whole process. Like, by the time my second book came out, some light bulb was going on in my head. I was going, oh my God, I got an actual agent. I was about five steps behind the whole time. It's still surprising to me, because I think so much of it is based on luck. And I'm so aware, from having been an actor, that much of it is based on luck. It helps to be good at what you do. It helps to work hard. But unless things align for you just right, the other things won't do you any good. So I still can't believe at some level that this landed on the right desks at the right time and things just clicked. It's wonderful.
And does it change your life when you have that kind of success as a writer?
In practical terms, well, I have a home now. I don't have to have that fear of you know, being in rentals now and desperately wondering what I'll do if my landlord decides to sell up. So that's a huge change, that security. But I have to say, the big luxury on a day-to-day level is, when I was a broke actor, it was a phone bill that was terrifying, because you don't know how much it's going to be. Like the others, you have an idea. I'd be terrified of opening. I'd put it off for days. And now I have it on direct debit and I don't open it. And that is my little luxury. I don't open my phone.
Hannah Frank doesn't even need to think about money anymore. Okay, well, the Witch Elm is out in the shops now, I believe. Hannah French, thank you very much. And we'll take a break.
Thank you.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.